This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, is there a lot in the news today. We've got such a full show today, and plus, it's Anything Goes Friday and Anything Goes Summer. So if you've got anything on your mind, you're welcome to call in, and we will get to it. I want to go back to March 21st. Sandy Fitzgerald wrote a piece for Newsmax titled 2016 GOP Hopefuls Meeting with Key Donors at Koch Party. And Sandy writes, a large group of Republican presidential hopefuls will gather for lunch at billionaire conservative David Koch's oceanfront mansion in Palm Beach, Florida on Sunday and meet face-to-face with some of the party's most influential contributors. This meeting is in the Koch's 30,000-square-foot home. It's a sponsored as a fundraiser for the Republican Governors Association. They note that membership in the program, which is only open to chief executives, wealthy philanthropists, and entrepreneurs, requires donors to cough up at least $25,000 a year to participate. Real estate mogul Donald Trump, who is one of the donors, also is scheduled to attend the event. Now, just follow along with me on this. Here we've got the Koch brothers in March of this year, or perhaps April. I mean, it was in the spring. Bringing Scott Walker, Chris Christie, and Bobby Jindal, and Jeb Bush and Rick Perry, although Perry was not able to attend, down to David Koch's home in Florida to make their sales pitch to this group of billionaire donors. And among that group of billionaire donors was Donald Trump. Just think about this for a minute. If the billionaires decided that their guy, the guy who has most successfully and aggressively fulfilled the legacy of Ronald Reagan by destroying labor in Wisconsin, Scott Walker, And by, you know, going after, I mean, all kinds of things. It's just most recently, right now, the story over on Center for American Progress's blog. Today, Scott Walker prepares a signed budget that eliminates the living wage and the prevailing wage. This is Alice Olstein writing. This is the budget that Scott Walker is presumably going to sign today in Wisconsin, because next week he's going to announce he's running for president. So he's got to get all these, they call them conservative. I would call them right-wing credentials. A repeal of wage protections for construction workers on local government projects. The elimination of a worker's right to one day off a week. Now your employer can require that you work 7 days a week. Loosened regulations on payday lenders, a provision to expedite approval for a tar sands pipeline that would bisect the state, and eliminates the state's longstanding living wage law and replaces all reference to a living wage with the phrase minimum wage, which is $7.25 in Wisconsin. It's the federal minimum wage. So here we are at the Koch brothers with a group of billionaires, including Donald Trump. And the Republican candidates are auditioning for them. And Jeb Bush gets up and says, now this, keep in mind, this is all my fantasy. Jeb Bush gets up, or my imagination. Jeb Bush gets up and says, hey, you know, I had 80,000 African Americans thrown off the voting rolls in Florida so that my brother could, you know, basically steal Florida in 2000 and become president. I know how to play dirty politics. I can become president. And Chris Christie gets up and says, hey, hell, you want dirty tricks? Have you ever heard of Bridgegate? And Bobby Jindal gets up and says, we're pretty much set to eliminate abortion altogether in Louisiana. And the Kochs are, and the billionaires are sitting there going, yeah, well, this is nice, but what about our concerns? We're fossil fuel barons, right? The Kochs own millions of acres of tar sands oil up in Canada. What about the pipeline? What about labor? I mean, we've got all these companies, some of them are even unionized. We've got all these companies that Koch Industries owns that, you know, have these pesky workers who keep wanting raises and things. I mean, who's really going to crush the middle class? And Scott Walker stands up and says, not only am I going to do it, but I already did it in Wisconsin. They tried to kick me out. And, you know, with a little money from the Koch brothers, I was able to beat back the recall election, and I ran for re-election, and I got re-elected, and I can be the next president. Scott Walker says, I'm as slimy as Richard Nixon. When I was in college and running for elected office on campus, the local newspaper endorsed my opponent. My people stole all the newspapers from the newsstands. I've been lying and cheating through politics my entire life. We tried to do away with the sunshine disclosure laws, and if the press hadn't gotten a hold of it, I mean, we were trying to do it the middle of the night, and the billionaires are nodding their heads going, yeah, this is our guy. Scott Walker's our guy. He is pursuing the Reagan agenda, and he's got the Nixon morality, mentality, zeitgeist. This is our guy. But the problem, and so all the candidates, you know, Jeb Bush leaves and Bobby Jindal leaves and Chris Christie leaves and Scott Walker leaves, and the billionaires are sitting around together talking. And one of them says, but what are we going to do about Jeb Bush? I mean, he's going to raise a pile of money. It was just announced today in the New York Times that he leads all the Republicans. He's the first 6 months of the year. While his official campaign has not raised all that much, his super PACs, I mean, he's got, I think it was $140 million, some mind-boggling amount of money. So the billionaires are sitting there going, you know, Jeb Bush won't be terrible for us. He's going to protect our interests. I mean, he comes from an elite family, and his brother certainly protected our interests. But Scott Walker's really the guy we want. So who's going to take out Jeb Bush? And Donald Trump jumps up and raises his hand and says, I will. And they're like, really, how are you going to do that? And Donald Trump says, well, I'll run for president and I'll spend all my time bashing Jeb Bush and Rick Perry and everybody except Scott Walker. I'll bloody them all up from the inside, and Scott Walker will be the only guy left. And you guys raise $800 million and you can make him president of the United States. So my question to you, I have not been able to find this. Now, granted, I haven't spent, you know, days looking. But have you ever heard Donald Trump criticize Scott Walker? I mean, I heard him on TV in his interview with MSNBC. He called Chris Christie a blowhard or something like that. He called Jeb Bush a loser. Said it took him 5 days to figure out how to answer a question on Iraq. How do you expect him to negotiate with Iran? But I don't remember him saying one word about Scott Walker. Could it be that the billionaires got together and Donald Trump is part of this and we're all just being played for suckers? I mean, remember, Nixon in 72 knew that Ed Muskie, the senator from Maine, would beat him in the general election. So somebody slipped some LSD in Ed Muskie's coffee, and Ed Muskie ended up during a campaign stop standing on the back of a flatbed truck hallucinating and crying about his wife. And suddenly he was out of the race and George McGovern was in, who Nixon knew he could beat. So Nixon's plan was, you don't win in the general election. You win by picking your opposition. Or making sure that your guy gets out there. So what do you think? Am I crazy?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I ran this by Pap last night on TV, and he's like, I don't think so, but We'll be back. And welcome back. Marcia in Englewood, Florida, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Marcia. Or is it Marcia?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you again. I've been wondering, has anybody besides me watched, with all due respect, on Bloomberg, where the representative or the senator Chris Coons from Delaware says that he's, in quotes, "I quite frankly am hoping for someone with more seasoning," meaning of Bernie Sanders. He doesn't feel Bernie Sanders has enough qualifications to run for president.
Yeah.
And that's on the tail of McCaskill, and her.
Well, Bernie's got basically, Bernie was a congressman. He was a mayor, a congressman, and a senator. Jack Kennedy was a congressman and a senator. So, yeah, Bernie's as qualified as Jack Kennedy was.
I'm wondering if the meaning of seasoning means that he doesn't have one of those, what do you call it, that collects all the money
super
for
PACs.
Them. He doesn't have a super PAC. Is that what he's not seasoned means?
I have no idea, but
I haven't seen a word about it anywhere. When Claire McCaskill says anything, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
This guy Coons is under a rock somewhere.
Yeah. Every time I've seen one of these Democratic insiders attacking Bernie Sanders, they have done it exclusively with slurs, essentially. Chris Coons saying he's not seasoned. Claire McCaskill saying he's too radical. They never say, Bernie Sanders' plan to save Social Security won't work, or Bernie Sanders' plan to put Americans back to work won't work, or Bernie Sanders' plan to walk away from our trade deals and put together a trade policy that's America first won't work. I've never heard any of them bring up any of the issues. Have you?
No, not a one.
Yeah.
They all bash each other, but...
Yeah, that speaks a lot to me. I think that tells us, what's really going on, which is that, Hillary's starting to get a little concerned about Bernie, and...
Oh, by the way, he did say he would rather see Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton
right.
as the Democratic nominee.
Right. Well,
that speaks volumes too.
Well, I keep saying the biggest lesson that I've learned, and I had heard this for years, but I never really took it all that seriously. But the biggest lesson that I have learned living and working in this town in Washington, D.C. for the last 5 years is that it's not about Democrats and Republicans. It's not about conservatives and liberals. It's not about right and left. It's about insiders and outsiders. And the insiders take care of themselves.
I'm agreeing with you on that.
The insiders take care of themselves, and they keep the outsiders out. And Bernie has historically been an outsider. He refused to join the Democratic Party until now he's running as a Democrat, but he still has not changed his senatorial affiliation, his affiliation in the state of Vermont. So I don't take it all that seriously. We'll see where this goes. It's getting very, very interesting. Marcia, thank you for the call, and thank you for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It is 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Okay, there's a few other things here. Rants I want to get under my belt, and then we'll just pick up phone calls for the rest of the day. The Pope has come out and said the church was complicit in the destruction of native peoples in the Americas. And now Pope John Paul II actually said words to this effect, but thank you. But the Pope saying this is a big deal. He said, and of course he's in Bolivia drinking coca leaf tea, by the way. He had part of one of his lungs removed when he was a child because of an infection. So and Bolivia and what is it? La Paz is the capital. I've been there once, and it was just to change planes. I mean, I looked out the window, but actually maybe I spent the night there. I don't remember. It was many, many years ago, but I was flying Air France. I was just hopscotching up through South America from Colombia back to Boston, but. In any case, here's what the Pope said. He said, I say this to you with regret. Many grave sins were committed against the native people of America in the name of God. I humbly ask forgiveness, not only for the offense of the church herself, but also for the crimes committed against the native peoples during the so-called conquest of America. Isn't that extraordinary? There's an interesting article in the BBC. Before I share this story with you, I want to give you a little bit of backstory. In It had to be 2001. It was in the spring of 2001. George W. Bush was president. The United States, Europe, and Russia were all having a heroin problem. And the heroin was all coming from opium poppies being grown in Afghanistan. So George W. Bush went to the Taliban and said, we will give you, my recollection is it was $20 or $40 million. It was not a great deal of money. I don't think it was even $100 million. We will give you X millions. Now, keep in mind, Afghanistan was the second poorest country on earth. The average annual income in Afghanistan was less than $700 a year. Second poorest country on earth. And the world's largest supplier of raw opium for heroin. It was their principal export. So Bush goes to the Taliban and says, we'll give you this money if you'll burn the poppy fields. And pass the money out to the warlords and whatnot. And, you know, just say, you know, we're basically buying your opium before it's produced. So just burn it. And they did. The Taliban took the money and they kept their word. And the worldwide supply of heroin plunged, and therefore the price of heroin exploded in late 2001 and throughout 2002. But the other thing that happened in 2001 was 9/11, and what happened toward the end of 2000, or what happened in early 2002, as I recall, is that Bush started bombing Afghanistan. Remember that? Well, as soon as he started bombing Afghanistan, they started growing opium poppies again. I mean, you know, you got to feed your family. And these are farmers who've been growing opium poppies for 5,000 years. So here comes this story on the BBC. And it's being spun by folks like at the CDC as the reason for this is there's too much hillbilly heroin out there. There's too much oxycodone out there. People are getting hooked on painkillers. Doctors need to stop writing the prescriptions because once they get addicted to these narcotics, they then move to heroin. Because heroin's cheaper. The first sentence of the article is also the first paragraph. It says the number of heroin users rose by 63%. Heroin use in the U.S. has surged in the last decade. The number of heroin users rose by 63% between 2002 and 2013, according to the CDC. 63% increase in heroin use. Why? Well, in my opinion, the reason why is because they're growing opium poppies again like crazy, like there's no tomorrow in Afghanistan. Because once we bombed their country and once we kind of took it over and all this kind of stuff, we stopped the program to prevent them from growing opium. There's all kinds of heroin out there, all kinds of it. Sanctuary laws. I want to get into this. There's this, you know, the Mexican immigrant who was in the country without documentation. Had been arrested 7 times, had been deported 5 times, ended up back in San Francisco and killed a woman last week. He is quickly becoming Willie Horton. Right? The Republicans are saying, you know, this is because San Francisco is a, quote, sanctuary city, which means that their police department will not play an enforcement role on deportation. Their police department in San Francisco will not arrest people simply for being there without documentation. Now, there's actually a good reason for this. And the reason for this is that there are people in San Francisco, just like there are in every other city in America, without documentation, who came here because Reagan stopped enforcing the law against largely white wealthy employers hiring people who aren't here legally. And when he stopped enforcing that law, people started coming here saying, hey, I'll take that job. And the problem is that, you know, say, husband and wife come And then husband starts beating the crap out of wife, but both of them are here without documentation. The wife is afraid to call 911 because she's afraid that the police will arrest her for being here illegally and she'll be deported. So, you know, whether it's robbery or rape or spousal abuse or whatever it may be, people are afraid to report it. So San Francisco said, you know, we're going to be a sanctuary city. We're not going to let our police be agents of ICE. Which makes perfect sense to me. On the other hand, this guy had been deported 5 times. And he'd been arrested 7 times, if my memory serves me right. What do we do about that?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So, a lot to talk about. These are just a couple. I've got a whole huge stack here. We'll get to the rest of it as the show progresses. Your calls are up next. It's the True People's Media. Talk media for the rest of us. The Tom Hartman Program. And welcome back. Benjamin in Madison, Mississippi. Hey, Benjamin, what's on your mind today?
Well, several things, Tom. you know, I'm surprised that you took this situation in San Francisco as a political thing and tried to look at it like it's only Republicans that think that Americans' lives should be saved.
I never said that, Benjamin.
You know.
I thought that what I did was I laid out both sides of the argument. One side of the argument is that
you tried to use that silly situation about Willie Horton, like everybody just used him because he was black, and you know he was the only to do disregard him because he was black. I mean, the media is MSNBC, CNN are not even mentioning this story. The president will not even comment on it.
Right, and Fox is all over it.
The press secretary will not even say anything.
And Fox is all over it. And Fox is living it. Okay, Benjamin, thanks for your call. Derek in Mauston, Wisconsin. Hey, Derek, what's on your mind? I'm sorry, I'm not in a mood to suffer fools gladly today. Go ahead, Derek.
Yeah, no problem.
I ended up debating. Pardon me, Derek. I debated David Duke on TV last night. It's like, okay, I've had my fill of fools. Go ahead, Derek.
No, it's all good. Okay, so I have a concern with this whole push to raise the minimum wage. Now, I want the minimum wage to be increased, but I'm concerned that if we don't deal with the free trade first, it will actually cost us in the long run. And then the second part of the question would be, is it even possible to somehow reverse all of this free trade and get these jobs back here? Because these are done with other countries, and I know it's extremely complex, but is it even doable?
Yes, it's easily doable. It's easily doable. It just requires, you know, a Congress and a president who agree that it needs to be done. But it's easily doable. We can get out of treaties that we've gotten into. We may have, you know, it may cost us a little over the short term, but over the long term, I mean, we're $11 trillion in the hole right now because of these treaties going back to NAFTA and permanent normal trade relations, which yesterday I was blaming on Reagan, and I found out it happened during the Clinton administration. But it's entirely possible. Now, with regard to the minimum wage on service workers, basically, I mean, our economy has flipped from being basically founded on manufacturing. Manufacturing, when Reagan came into office, about a third of our economy. My recollection is it was 34%. I could be wrong, though. But it was a substantial chunk of our economy, somewhere between a quarter and a third of our economy was manufacturing. Now it's, as I recall, it's down around 11%. And countries, once you slip below that 15% level, you're not even considered really a manufacturing-based economy any longer. So, but yeah, we could bring those jobs back. I mean, we've got the consumers here. We're buying manufactured goods, all of us, all the time. But as I look around me, everything I see, from the light bulbs to the cameras to the computer in front of me to the clothes I'm wearing, they're all made offshore. And it's just a matter of changing your trade policies to open up opportunities for American entrepreneurs to start making everything, you know, all around you, which is the way it was pre-Reagan. So, yeah.
I think I read or heard somewhere that doesn't the U.S. consume something like 80% of the world's manufactured goods or something crazy like, isn't it?
No, I'd be really surprised high? If it was anything close to that high, but it is substantial. And, you know, the larger question is what percentage of the consumer goods, you know, about 70% of the U.S. economy is, in fact, somewhere between 70 and 80% is entirely driven by consumer spending. And then you've got another 20% that is government spending. And
okay. So
the more money you can put in the hands of consumers, the more they will buy because, you know, the vast majority of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. If you increase their paycheck, you will increase what they're buying. Some small amount will go to savings, but historically it's, you know, it's less than 5%. So and as demand increases, they start buying more things. Now, if you change your trade policy so that those things are made in the United States, then raising the minimum wage starts to enrich the United States. If you don't change your trade policies, then raising the minimum wage, you know, it'll have some small knock-on effect. It'll help locally. I mean, you know, money will go through one or two or three hands before it ends up in China. If you were manufacturing things here in the United States, money would go through 100 or 200 hands before it leaves the country, and in many cases it never would. So that's the situation. Derek, thanks for the call. Greg in Somerville, South Carolina. Oh, the battle flag for Robert E. Lee's Northern Virginia Army was taken down from the South Carolina grounds of the South Carolina State House today. I think everybody at Fox News is wearing black armbands. Greg, you wanted to talk about the Civil War?
Yes, sir. Yes, and I watched that flag come down this morning with tears of joy in my eyes. Yes, sir. I was. I often get in discussions down here. I've lived in South Carolina for about 10 years. A lot of discussions about the Civil War and that flag, and I was hoping to get a little history lesson from you. Kind of a two-part question. Did the rich landowners, slave owners in the South somehow trick the poor Southerners into fighting the Civil War for them? And if so, is there a parallel between that and what the Koch brothers are doing today to get the Tea Party basically to do their dirty work for them?
Yeah. I honestly don't know. I'm not that much of a scholar of Civil War history. I do know that there was conscription on both sides, in both the Union and the Confederacy. So a lot of poor white Southerners were conscripted. They were drafted. And I think it's really important when we talk about the South and when we talk about the Civil War to differentiate between many good people who showed up for the war without, you know, thinking in terms of the larger issues. You know, why are we having this war? What's going on? I mean, very rarely in wars do people think about these things. On the one hand, and in fact, in the next hour, I'm gonna go off on our adventures in the Middle East and George W. Bush's role in them and all these kind of things. But the soldiers who went to Iraq were not thinking, oh, gee, I'm gonna go fight a war based on a lie. A lot of them thought they were there because of 9/11, you know, which Saddam Hussein had absolutely nothing to do with, and Iraq had nothing to do with. And so I'm guessing that there were probably a lot of poor white Southern soldiers in the Confederate Army who were either drafted or they thought they were defending, you know, their end of the country. And in their mind, they weren't there to defend slavery. Slavery was one piece of the larger threat of, hey, I live in the South. On the other hand, we have to be very, very certain and very clear to point out that the secession statements of the South Carolina Declaration of Secession mentioned slavery 18 times. The Mississippi Declaration of Secession explicitly says slavery is part and parcel of the South. The vice president of the Confederacy in his cornerstone speech, you know, this is the cornerstone of the Confederacy. This is who we are and why we're fighting. Goes on about how black people are adapted to living in the sun and working in the sun, and therefore they're the appropriate slaves and you know all this kind of stuff. I mean, it was just at the level of the senior leadership and the money. I mean, there was in 1860. There were 75% of the net productivity of the United States was coming out of the South, and almost all of it was coming from slave labor. and or the vast majority of it, of our both internally consumed and export goods. Slavery was not going away in 1860. In fact, it was hitting a real they were hitting their stride. And one of the stories that the David Dukes of the world like to tell is, oh, slavery was going to fade out and go away. No. Britain had outlawed it back in the 1820s, but, you know, it was alive and well here. So with regard to whether the rich tricked the poor into fighting their war, I'd say, you know, probably. But I'm not sure that the white poor were all that upset about slavery in the South, frankly. And you know, to this day, I mean, you still see this kind of thing happening. Greg, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Don in Gannonsburg, Pennsylvania. What's up, Don?
Hi, Tom. I was reading the paper today, and I saw the an article about how consumer debt is really, really high, you know, like it always is. And I was wondering, oh, maybe I'm nuts, but I'm thinking that the resistance to raising the minimum wage has something to do with an allegiance to the banks and them lending money to poor people at these outrageous rates. You know, a guy who's making a minimum wage can't even afford to go out and buy a television set,
right,
without borrowing the money.
Yeah.
And, you know, he thinks he owns a nice TV, but he doesn't. You know, the TV owns him. The banks own him. And if he gets a $15 an hour wage, he won't have to borrow that money from the banks.
You're right.
I'm wondering if that's a conscious thing that's, you know, in the minds of those who are resisting raising the minimum wage.
It would be interesting to see. I mean, if you look at the politicians who are opposed to the minimum wage, which is basically the entire Republican Party, they are largely wholly owned by the banking and fossil fuel industries and the pharmaceutical industries. But whether there's a conscious – I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me. Whether there's a conscious – you know, whether the banksters are sitting around going, you know, hey, we can make money off poverty – And they do, by the way. A lot of people make money off poverty. Hey, we can make money off poverty, more money than we can make off a middle class. I don't know. I mean, it may well be that the banksters could make more money off a strong middle class. Don, that hadn't occurred to me. It's an interesting one. Let me think about that for a day or three. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Great thoughtful calls today. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Amy in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Amy, what's up? Thanks for watching from Free Speech TV.
I heard on 92.1 on the Devil's Advocates, a local show, redistricting in Wisconsin. The Democrats are suing the Republicans because they knew it was illegal, and the Legislative Reference Bureau, which tells them about the law, told them that.
Mm-hmm.
And an ex-moderate Republican was part of it, and they didn't involve Democrats, and they didn't use the census properly. So a three-judge panel is looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that was interesting.
I think it's very interesting. So, I mean, you know, that lawsuit very similar to that just won in Florida, where the Republicans had gerrymandered the state. And so that's...
Yeah, well, this is really interesting because I think we have a good chance.
Yeah, yeah. I think you may.
For the federal court.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the heads up, Amy. I appreciate that, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Bob in Bullhead City, Arizona. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech on DirecTV.
Thank you, Tom. I'm really glad the way you handled that caller from San Francisco. I'm glad you got your cool back.
Well, I would be glad to have a conversation with somebody who disagrees with me about this, but, you know, sure. Shouting each other down is no way to have a conversation.
No, sir, it's ridiculous. It's a waste. But my comment would be that the Southern Confederate flag that is flying in all government buildings really should be replaced and put the POW MIA flag up. I think that would be a wonderful thing for this nation.
I didn't know there was a POW MIA flag. What is that?
Oh, yes, sir. It's a black flag. And it's got a white background of a soldier, and it says that you will never be forgotten. This flag has been out for many years, sir.
Oh yeah,
yes, sir.
Okay, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yes, and there are government buildings that do fly that flag. So I would suggest to the South, you know, that they would honor all the POW and MIA veterans of all wars.
Yeah. Well, you know, Robert E. Lee asked his soldiers to furl the flag, to put the flag away. Robert E. Lee ultimately freed his slaves. I mean, of course, he lost the war. He couldn't keep them anymore anyway. But about within a year of losing the war, Robert E. Lee reapplied for citizenship to the United States of America. It's like what people don't get is that Confederate flag has not been flying over all these state capitals ever since the Civil War. It's been ever since the late 50s and early 60s. And the flag, the Confederate flag, was put into the flags of several southern states in opposition to forced segregation of schools in the early 60s and late 50s. And over the state capitol in South Carolina, et cetera. This is less than 60 years old, this whole thing, or 70 years old. This is stuff that happened in our parents' and grandparents' generation, not stuff that happened during the Civil War. Between the Civil War and the 1950s, the Confederate flag was pretty much nothing but the flag of the KKK. And I think it's going to go back to that status now. I think that, you know, hopefully. Bob, thank you for the call. Interesting idea. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. It's interesting, 10 minutes before the hour. You can always tell the callers who are heavy Fox News watchers because they want to try to filibuster you, or me specifically, and talk over me. And what they don't understand, because that's how they do it on Fox News, but what they don't understand, and it always seems like the conservatives win when they do that, when they have one of these shouting matches with somebody and everybody's talking over each other. What they don't realize is that when they do that on Fox News, they pot down, they reduce just slightly. You have to know how this business works to know that it's happening. Normally, the gain levels of both the caller or the guest and the host are the same. And so if people start talking over each other, it's just it becomes gibberish. It becomes unintelligible. So what they'll do is they'll turn down the volume of the liberal and keep Hannity's volume high so that everybody can hear the conservative argument being made, and the liberal argument kind of fades into gibberish, even though he's still talking. And it's a lousy way to do things. It's a lousy way to run a talk show or anything else. Chris, I don't have a city for you. Where are you calling from?
Portland, Oregon.
Okay, you want to talk about heroin?
Yeah, you were mentioning heroin was on the rise, and you were connecting that to the Afghan opium fields.
Yes.
The interesting thing, though, about heroin in America is on the West Coast, it primarily comes from the Mexican cartels. On the East Coast, the Colombian cartels. And the heroin from the opium fields in Afghanistan is actually primarily being trafficked into Russia's heroin and then to Iran via Baluchistan as opium, since they have more of a taste for opium than heroin there. And you might see that the Afghan fields are going to destabilize certain enemies of the United States, and that we've in the past made agreements with Mexican and Central American cartels.
Yeah, you're right, Chris, and largely right anyway. This is a real crisis for Russia right now. I mean, they're seeing an explosion of heroin use, and along with it, an explosion in overdose deaths and HIV infections. And not just Russia. I mean, you know, the former Eastern European countries, even Western Europe, is having this problem. But the point that I was making is that when you dump a couple thousand tons of heroin into the marketplace anywhere in the world every single month, as Afghanistan is doing, you depress worldwide heroin prices, even though the Afghan heroin may not be ending up, or most of it is not ending up in the United States. It's adding to the supply. Also, I understand that I may be wrong on this, but I've read that some of the Mexican suppliers of heroin are bringing in opium from the Middle East, from Afghanistan, and processing it in Mexico and converting it to heroin. Although there are poppy fields,
that's a likely possibility as well.
Yeah,
hard to confirm.
Yeah. So, but, you know, it's sort of like the worldwide oil market. I mean, if one supplier just, you know, is like, you know, when demand for oil, or excuse me, when the supply of oil went up as a consequence of all the fracking that we're doing in the United States, Saudi Arabia could have kept the price high by simply dialing back their production. Instead, they kept their production high, which caused the price to crash. So, you know, it doesn't matter where you're selling it. If you're selling it into a worldwide marketplace, and it's a worldwide marketplace for heroin, you're going to depress prices. And that's what's happened. But yeah, your point is well taken. Thank you, Chris, for calling and making it. Danny in New Orleans. Hey, Danny, you wanted to talk about heroin too?
I did, Tom. And actually, I'm just adding on to what the guy from Portland said, pretty much. I agree with him. A lot of what's coming into New Orleans right now, I believe, is coming out of Mexico as well. And I think it's also a function of, and believe me, I'm pro-weed legalization, but I think that the more the pot that's domestically grown in America becomes more and more legal, quasi-legal, price goes down, a lot of these guys south of the border, they can't make the money off of that anymore, so they're moving into the poppy business.
Right.
I think that's what's been, I don't know what to do about it, but I think that's an unintended consequence of our legalization effort.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think what to do about it is what Portugal did, and I believe Ecuador might have done the same thing. Oh, Uruguay. Thank you, Troy. Which is decriminalize all drugs and just say drug abuse is not a crime anymore, period. Nobody's going to go to jail for it. And we are going to set up clinics. Drug abuse is a disease. Drug addiction is a disease. Drug abuse is a public health issue. And we're going to set up clinics for this and offer needle exchanges for people so that they're not transmitting HIV from person to person and work with the people who want to get off these drugs to get off them. When England legalized heroin and just turned it into a simple prescription drug back, in the 90s, I think it was. It was, actually, it might have been before that, because I think my recollection is that Maggie Thatcher put an end to it, so it might have been the 70s. But it was in my lifetime, and it was an experiment that lasted about a decade, as I recall. I'd have to go back and look. I tried to open the chat room earlier, and it wouldn't open. I should try that again. I'm going to try it again, because I'm sure that Sue could tell me what's going on with that. And what they found was that, you know, I mean, literally doctors and lawyers and factory workers and whatnot were heroin addicts already, and they were and many of them were unable to make a living, sort of thing. And once they started using legal heroin that they were getting from their doctor by prescription, using it cleanly and safely in the privacy of their own homes, they went back to work. And because heroin is very much like tobacco, it gets you really high the first week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks that you use it. You get a great buzz off it. And after that, you stop getting high from it. You simply take it to avoid the withdrawal. Tobacco addicts are tobacco and heroin work. Their addiction mechanisms are not that dissimilar. There's different receptor sites, but the mechanism is not that dissimilar. And so, you know, just like tobacco folks, you know, the relief that they get when they smoke after they've been addicted more than a couple of weeks is not, oh boy, do I feel stoned. It's, oh boy, do I no longer feel anxiety over the withdrawal symptoms I'm starting to experience. And it's the same thing with heroin. And what they found was that typically people would spontaneously quit using heroin within 3 to 5 years. That was the average period of time. And just on their own, because, you know, it just, like, it became a hassle. It wasn't part of their lifestyle. It was, you know, that sort of thing. Heroin is less addictive, just for the record, than is tobacco. So I think that that's the solution, Danny. But, you know, I know a lot of people disagree with me. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's coming up on the top of the hour. We'll catch the news at the top of the hour. We'll be back with, I got to tell you about George W. Bush, wounded veterans, Donald Trump, and what a veteran has to say about it after the break.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I was talking a little earlier about the heroin problem worldwide and how it came about in some part as a consequence of George W. Bush dropping bombs rather than money on Afghanistan. He dropped money on Afghanistan in early 2001, And in exchange for them burning their poppy fields, which they did, the Taliban did, and the worldwide price of heroin went up, and worldwide addiction rates, particularly in Europe and Russia, went down, which was a positive outcome. But it also was true here in the United States. It's why George W. Bush did this, sending tens of millions of dollars to the Taliban. Now Bush is being criticized by many for having spoken to a Wounded Warriors veterans group. Just consider the irony here. These are wounded veterans. The vast majority of them, I would be willing to bet, are veterans of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that George W. Bush lied us into. And he charged that this Wounded Warrior Veterans group, he charged them $100,000 for him to give a speech to them. Which brings me to an interesting colloquy, shall we say, between Facebook and one of the posters over at Democratic Underground. A fellow by the name of Jim Adams posted on Facebook day before yesterday at 10 o'clock. He said, if you're a Republican, don't you dare thank me for my military service. You no longer have that right. You sent us to war on a lie. You cut our health benefits, and now you're cutting our food. He's talking about the Republican sequester and the Republican budget that cuts food stamps. He says, you have voted against every veterans bill that has hit the floor. You don't give a F about us, so don't effing pretend to. We are the 47% you like to refer to as the takers. So from all of us veterans out here, screw you. His language is just a little bit more colorful. In response to that, a fellow by the name of, whose screen name over at DU, Democratic Underground, is Shadow Mayor, posted a response. This was yesterday, titled, WMD's My Ass. He says, thanks for posting this. I spent 2005 or OIF-3 or two Thomas Friedman, suck on this unit's worth of time, in Abu Ghraib prison, where we brought liberty and freedom to thousands of Iraqis detained and trapped inside of fences within high walls. Didn't believe in the war before I went, while I was there, and certainly not after I returned. But I was a soldier, and I couldn't live with the thought of another going in my place. It's complicated. I was a stop-lost, cross-leveled engineer sent in with the MP reserves out of New York. We had more lead, RPGs, and mortars and rockets rained on Abu Ghraib than any spot in Iraq. It was truly a hellhole beyond description. Did the soldiers torture and humiliate prisoners before we arrived? You betcha, as Palin might say. But those who ran the show, the contract employees and the officers, they didn't get blamed, naturally. The deaths and rapes and more were never released to the public. Wonder why? We were told we were a liberating force, not an occupying force. Camp Remembrance, where most of the Iraqis were detained, was to remind us all of those brave firemen and police officers who died on 9/11. Yet while we were there, the boy president let it slip that Iraq had nothing to do with the attacks in New York. Not to be deterred, we Charlie Mike'd for the rest of the year. Had a front row view of the phony elections, drove down the roads, saw the murderous carnage unleashed by our war machine, and listened intently to groups of Sunni prisoners tell me around May of 05 that the U.S. should leave as we were killing too many people and the Shiites were taking over. That was the point where the Civil War was a done deal, thanks to our war pigs in charge. I spoke out openly against the invasion, to the chagrin of many in our unit at first, but by the end of my tour, a great many had changed their minds. Senators Schumer and Clinton were sent several letters begging them to help remove the Iraqis from Abu Ghraib, as it was in violation of the Geneva Conventions regarding protecting those under an army's charge and keeping them from harm and away from the battlefield. Crickets on that big one, on that one, folks, big crickets. ISIS was formed in our prisons, detention centers, like Abu Ghraib and Bucca, B-U-C-C-A. I refuse to refer to them as ISIS, as they're really Al-Qaeda 3.0. Why aren't any of our generals fired? Why are our politicians and media so easily fooled by the BS surge? I came back to a brain-dead country that had no idea what was going on, much of it in our name. Apparently, Abu Ghraib was selected by that well-known incarceration and war expert, Paul Wolfowitz, as he found it to be centrally located. The list of screw-ups, disasters, and wanton disregard for the Iraqi people is endless. It really is a case of join the army, see the world, meet interesting people, and kill them. Hardy effing har har. So when a dip repuke tries to thank me, I am no longer polite. In other words, a Republican. I tell him, no, let me thank you for voting for the bastards who led us into this terrible war where millions of Iraqis lie dead and homeless and suffering, where our treasure was hemorrhaged to feed KBR and other private war profiteers, and where my buddies and I came back broken, both physically and psychically. And now we're expected to man up and be quiet about all that crap? And if a Democrat dares to thank me, I simply say, you have got to be effing kidding me, right? Because if you don't know what a terrible insult that is, well, lend your ear, and I'll tell you a little bit about what war is really like, and I am positive you won't enjoy it one damn bit. And I always ask, where the hell did the people of Iraq, what the hell did the people of Iraq ever do to the people of the USA? Time to exhale the shadow mirror. George W. Bush charging $100,000 to a group of, over 6,000 American soldiers died in Iraq and Afghanistan, fighting absolutely unnecessary wars. Keep in mind, the Taliban offered, right after 9/11, the Taliban offered to arrest Osama bin Laden and present him to a third country for trial. And George Bush said, nope, we want to have a war. Because back in 1999, he had told Mickey Herskowitz, who was ghostwriting his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, in anticipation of his run for the presidency, he had told Mickey Herskowitz that, you know, my daddy had all his capital built up when he invaded Iraq, and he blew it. I mean, George Herbert Walker Bush's war was only 100 hours long, remember? He says, if I get elected president, if I have an opportunity, I'm going to invade Iraq, and I'm not going to blow that. I'm going to use all that political capital you get from being a war president and have a successful presidency, which meant, in his mind, privatizing Social Security. You'll recall, after the 2004 elections, in 2005, the first thing he said was, I've got all this political capital from the election. I'm going to spend it right now. We're going to privatize Social Security. And he tried. Unsuccessfully, but he tried. It's really quite mind-boggling when you think about it. I mean, in some ways, it's even beyond quite mind-boggling. It's like criminally mind-boggling. I raised this question earlier, and I want to raise it again just, you know, in the hope of some sort of a sane conversation. The New York Times today has a headline, was Donald Trump right about the immigrant sanctuary laws? San Francisco says our police are not going to be immigration police. We're here to protect people and serve people who are being the victims of criminals, regardless of who they are and where they came from. And I understand that, but I also understand that being here without documentation is in and of itself a crime. And so what do we do? Now, it seems to me like, you know, there's two pieces to this solution. And rather than going after San Francisco or trying to make, you know, this murderer into the next Willie Horton, I think the thing to do is, number one, we do comprehensive immigration reform. And number two, as part of that, we start putting people in jail for employing people who come here without documentation from any country in the world. And we put an end to the abuse of the H-1B visa program where Disney, like, you know, lays off 300 American programmers and brings them in from overseas.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our immigration laws, ever since Reagan stopped enforcing the laws against employers, it's just been a mess. I got to tell you about Andrew Jackson, too, but, you know, there's a limit. Patrick in Paradise, California. Hey, Patrick, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Patrick, can you hear me? Patrick must have his phone muted. You got to listen to your phone rather than the television because there's about a minute delay on the TV and there's about a 10-second delay on the radio. Iris, watching Free Speech TV in Hollywood. And if you can hear me and I can't hear you, just hang up and call us right back. Iris in Hollywood, Florida.
Hi.
Hey, Iris. Thanks for watching Free Speech
TV.
How
are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. Myself and my six-year-old son are watching you. We always watch you.
And thank you.
Hi.
He's laughing right now.
Hi.
Hi.
So I have a question.
Sure.
I wanted to know about the TPP. I heard about it, but I'm not really sure of what it is, and I just wanted you to elaborate on it.
Sure. It's an agreement among, I believe, 12 countries, all who border on the Pacific, that they will allow that they are going to set up new rules for trade. It's not, this is the exact opposite of free trade. This is heavily regulated trade. And so countries, for example, that might be making drugs that are there, you know, they're making generic drugs in their countries so that their people can have access to cheap medications. The big pharmaceutical companies say, hey, we've got a patent on that. You can't do that. They're saying, but we're not in your country. We can do it here. It'll put an end to that. So everybody will have to buy drugs from the big pharmaceutical companies at a high price and high profits. Just one example. The same thing happens in industry after industry and after industry. Monsanto will get to sell their stuff wherever they want. And then if anybody has any problems with any of this stuff, there's a court, they call them tribunals, made up of three judges who are all corporate lawyers who will decide whether a country is engaging in unfair trade, what they refer to as unfair trade practices. In other words, well, for example, in the United States, the same thing happened with the World Trade Organization just 2 weeks ago. We had passed back years ago a law that said that when you sell meat in the supermarket, if it's not American-grown beef, it has to have the country of origin labeled on the package. It has to say, you know, beef from Argentina, beef from Mexico, you know, beef from the Congo, beef from whatever. And under the World Trade Organization, a couple of countries, or a couple of actually the meat producers in those countries functionally, but they did it through their countries, sued us and said that's an illegal restraint of trade. And we acceded. We said, okay, we'll change the law. And in fact, John Boehner, you know, had this thing introduced into Congress last week to do away with the country of origin labeling. And it passed the House. I think it's passed the Senate and gone to the president for his signature. So we're now in compliance with the WTO. So basically it means that more countries are going to surrender their sovereignty, and the United States is going to surrender its sovereignty to these countries, Vietnam and Brunei and Chile and Australia and whatnot. And beyond that, most of it is a secret. There are 28 chapters to this. Only five deal with actually trade. The rest of them deal with things like intellectual properties, patents, copyrights, the internet. I mean, you know, heaven only knows what's all in this. We're going to have 60 days to look at it when they finally finish negotiating it. And I have a feeling it's going to be a real horror show. Iris, thank you for the call. And greetings to you and your son. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, you wanted to get back to the Confederate flag and Civil War and all that kind of stuff?
Well, not necessarily the Confederate flag, but, you know, something that keeps going on. You know, they keep talking about Robert E. Lee. And one of the points Robert E. Lee made, he went to fight for the Confederacy reluctantly.
Yes.
But it was all about because he was a native of Virginia and he. And people back then really thought of their home states as being their home country.
Yeah, particularly the slave states.
The New Yorkers and Ohioans and all the others, too, because people back then didn't, you know, pick up and relocate across state lines the way they do now.
Hmm.
Yeah, you know, most people, I mean, there were exceptions, but most people, you if you were born in Ohio, you were going to, unless you went off and died in a war, you were going to die in Ohio.
Right.
Or New Jersey or New York or, you know, whatever it was. You settled, you put down your roots, you had kids.
Well, also, pre-Civil War, the states had actually a lot more power than the federal government did. Lincoln, the Civil War actually changed the nature of America. Before the Civil War, we had strong states and weak federal government. After the Civil War, we had a strong federal government and weaker states, relatively speaking.
But I was just saying, you know, making the point that it's the way people thought of themselves, you know, people didn't say I'm an American. They would say I'm an Ohioan or a South Carolinian or
right.
You know, Georgian, you know, whatever state they were born and raised in, that's what they were. That was how they described their identity.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. What do we do with that information? I'm sorry?
Yeah, I mean, that's just, you know, there it is, you know, information, you know, I mean, which now we're different. But about the TPP, you know, these things are agreements, are they not? They are not treaties ratified by two-thirds of the Senate, so they can be changed.
Yeah, I believe so. And even treaties can be changed. I mean, George W. Bush unsigned the anti-ballistic missile treaty. Said, you know, just we're no longer going to do that, you know.
Well, I don't know that that's quite legal if anybody challenged it, but, you know, like the NAFTA and CAFTA and, you know, whatever other ones they've got going, if Bernie Sanders does get elected, he could say, well, it's time we're no longer going to agree with that because it's an economic suicide pact.
Yeah, or Donald Trump. You know, I continue to think, it was fascinating to me last night. I was watching MSNBC, and I think it was Rachel's show, and there was this panel, and they were discussing, it might have been Chris Hayes' show, why is Donald Trump so popular? And the conclusion that they sort of came to is because he's all over the media. Now, they're the media, and they're talking about him, but and also because his trash-talking Mexicans, you know, appeals to a certain racist element within the Republican base, particularly in the South. I don't think that's it. I think that his trash-talking our trade negotiators and our trade deals is what has pushed him to the top of the Republican ticket. Keep in mind, right now he's pulling 14-15% of the Republican vote, and I think, frankly, he might pull some of the Democratic and Independent vote as well. And Ross Perot pulled 20% of the entire American electorate in 1992, and that was before we knew the kind of damage that these trade deals would do to our country.
Trump, I think, is just because anybody that's willing to poke a sharp stick in the eye of the establishment is going to get 20% of the vote.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree. And where I started the program an hour and a half ago was, is it possible that Trump is a stalking horse for his fellow billionaires in order to take down Jeb Bush? And also, you know, he's been attacking Hillary Clinton very aggressively also. But he doesn't say a word about Scott Walker. And I've been convinced for several years now, ever since these guys poured all this money into Wisconsin in order to help Scott Walker win the recall election, I've been convinced
The only thing to me that cast doubt on that theory is I don't know that Donald Trump is that much of a team player.
That's a good point. That's a good point. But, you know, if they said, you know, if you can take down a few of these guys so that we can push our guys, our buddy Scott Walker out front. On the other hand, maybe does want to be president.
Maybe he does. I don't know. I don't think he wants to work that hard.
Yeah, I agree. But you never know. You never know. Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Jonathan in Woodinville, Washington. Jonathan, you have an opinion on Trump?
You know, your last caller, you guys just covered exactly what I was talking about. And I just wanted to make the point, Tom, that I very, very respectfully disagree. I think you're right on with the stalking horse and Scott Walker argument. I'm from Wisconsin originally, but I just want to say I think the reason Trump's up, I don't think that the people that are putting him up in the polls are sophisticated enough to think about TPP. I think they're xenophobes and they're and I think the reason that's even underscored by the story today about Trump coming out and doubling down again on the birther thing with Obama. So I think he's really going for the lowest common denominator. But let me instead ask you a quick question that I wanted to follow up with. Both my senators, millionaire Cantwell and Murray, and then my millionaire representative from the First District, Susan DelBene, were trade turncoats on the TPP bill. What happened with the TEA and the XIM Bank that they were supposed to get in return? That all just disappeared? Where did that go?
It's a good question. It hasn't come before Congress yet, and I think the Export-Import Bank expires at the end of this month, doesn't it?
I think it might have been June, but
I think
Amanda Cantwell's big thing was she was going to horse trade, you know, for Boeing and get this XIM Bank thing, and you know, they were going to get the worker protections, and you know, so it was all really good for us in the end. But then all of a sudden, you know, TPP fast track passed, and then it's crickets on everything else. So you know, I guess Mitch McConnell kind of
There's a lesson in here for
Brown football.
Yeah, exactly. Charlie Brown and Lucy. Yeah. There's a lesson here for Democrats. Don't ever trust Mitch McConnell. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
Just don't ever trust them.
Lucy and the football, they just don't seem to get that lesson, do they?
Yeah. No, they don't. There's a nice fluff piece about Mitch McConnell in today's New York Times talking about how he's the he's one of the few Republicans who's not a racist. He, you know, it's like, really? Very strange. Jonathan, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's Anything Goes Friday and Anything Goes Summer. Do you know how Andrew Jackson got rich? You know, he's famous for having, you know, moved the Cherokees out of Georgia and into Oklahoma, the Trail of Tears. What he's not famous for is having gotten rich off that. I got to tell you that story. Well, maybe in the next hour. We'll pick up your phone calls after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
But it builds a strong case for, if we're going to put a woman on our dollar bills, don't take Hamilton off the 10, take Jackson off the 20. We'll be back. Back, Tom Hartman, here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. So yesterday I got in a cab, and the cabs here in D.C. now that we've mandated that they have to take credit cards, they've all got these little screens in the back of the cab like they've had in New York for a decade, where, you know, they play TV and they run commercials at you, and it's another revenue source for the cab companies, I'm sure. But it's also where you know, if you want to pay with a credit card, you punch in the stuff on the screen. So anyhow, I get in the cab, and the ad on the screen is Walmart. And it says, Walmart committed to spending $250 billion on manufacturing American goods, or American manufactured goods, or some words to that effect. And I'm looking at the AmericanManufacturing.org website, and I got a heads up on this from Omaha Steve over at DU. And it says corrected. There's this graphic that they put up. Corrected. Walmart, 2015. In January 2013, Walmart committed to American renewal by announcing it intends to purchase an additional $250 billion in products supporting U.S. jobs over 10 years. Here's what Walmart has actually done. They've increased imports to 775,400 shipping containers, a jump of 40,000 containers in the last year. Walmart boasts of relationships with nearly 20,000 Chinese suppliers. An estimated 2.7 million U.S. jobs have been lost due to imports from China. In 2003, Walmart announced a partnership with Element Electronics to reshore TV assembly to Winnsboro, South Carolina. Element wrapped all of its products in Americana, but only a few were even assembled in the U.S. The Federal Trade Commission found Element Electronics' ads were deceptive and ordered rebranding. Walmart estimated 1 million new U.S. jobs would be created through its initiative, but it created only 2,514 jobs in 2014. In 2014, Walmart imported almost 255,000 more shipping containers than the number two importer, Target, as they like to say. 5% of net sales is all Walmart pledged to spend on American goods in a single year. And two-thirds of what Walmart calls American goods are actually groceries. Not manufactured products. Gee, what a surprise. I remember sitting in the cab going, wow, they're good. $250 billion commitment to American-made goods. I didn't realize, A, it was over a 10-year period, and B, that it mostly was groceries. It's very strange. It's very strange. Sheila, is it Unicoi, Tennessee?
Yes, hi, Unicoi, Tennessee.
Hi, Sheila, what's up?
Hi, a little bit off topic, but I just wanted to publicly express my irritation at people who talk about the sanctity of life and yet they eat meat and dairy products three times a day without regard of the torture that these creatures endured to get on their dinner plates. Even after, I find that with family and friends, even after you educate them, most people just continue to do it without a thought. I just don't understand it. And the human body does not need, at least in this area of the world, does not need those things that come from meat and dairy products. We can live off of potatoes alone.
Yeah. Well, not exclusively. I mean, the Irish tried that and it didn't work. But yeah, we can live off of a wide variety of fruits and vegetables and grains. You're absolutely right, Sheila. And there's a great website for information about this. It's called nutritionfacts.org. It's put up by a physician, an MD, by the name of Dr. Greger. And down at the bottom of the homepage, there's three hour-long speeches that he gave. The one on the far right-hand corner, which he gave 3 or 4 years ago, about the 15 leading causes of death and what you can do about them. Every single one of those 15 leading causes of death, except accidents, is reduced by going on a plant-based diet. And I agree with you. The sanctity of life is one of the reasons why Buddhists, for example, don't eat, are vegetarian. It's why Hindus are vegetarian. And it's part of why I'm a vegetarian. So I'm with you, Sheila. Thank you. Thank you for the call.
And not to mention what it does to the planet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, you know, a pound of beef represents many gallons of water and many, many, many pounds of grain. And it's a very inefficient way for us to feed ourselves. Sheila, thank you for the call. Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Bob, what's up? You want to talk about Bill and Hillary?
Yes. The first major expose in the one of the most trusted media was the article in the Washington Post summing up the fortune that Bill has made over the last 14 years for making speeches. Their worth from mostly the speeches he's made at $350,000 or more per speech is $105 million.
Right.
That's the net worth of their personal fortune. It's not money that they spoke to get money for their foundation.
Right.
The worst case scenario, and it's something I would hope you'd have someone on to defend, is that there were 13 speeches Bill gave while Hillary was Secretary of State, and his fees went up to $500,000. I'd be glad to read the list of them per speech. Personal money, not foundation money.
Right.
Every one of those corporations, they include Dell, Oracle, had business before the State Department, and many of them saw their government contracts go from $28 million, or from $2 million to $28 million. I think that's in the case of Dell. I think if it wasn't Bill and Hillary Clinton, we would be looking at one of the most disgusting conflict of interest, probably something that one of the ethics branches in government would have to investigate and see how this happened. The State Department had the right to say no to any speech that Bill Clinton was about to give, and yet for some reason they said yes. They did not stop him from giving speeches.
Right.
And I think that this is a situation where in no time at all, as these kind of facts come out about how much money they've made or what they're worth, she is going to become almost an object of ridicule when she talks about working for everyday Americans. Her favorite phrase. I don't know why, if she wanted to become president, she found it necessary after finishing being Secretary of State herself to go out and make only $5 million from speeches. And we're talking every financial company, the biggest one being Goldman Sachs, that between them they spoke 6 times over the years, minimum,
right.
$250,000 to $350,000.
Bob, are you getting your information from the book Clinton Cash?
Yes, but I'm also getting it from International Business Times.
Okay.
I'm getting it from the Washington Post. Yes, I know that guy has an agenda.
Well, he not only has an agenda, there are a lot of factual inaccuracies in that book, but I think that broadly speaking, what you're talking about is mostly the case. And, you know, the Clintons would assert that there was a firewall of communication between Bill and Hillary, and that, you know, he was giving speeches, but he wasn't saying to Hillary, hey, be sure to help out with the contracts here. But, you know, yeah, I think it looks bad, and it's something that the Republicans are going to use against her if she is the nominee. And I think that
I wish Bernie would raise this issue.
He won't.
Exactly this kind of ethical dysfunction that we accuse and you accuse the Republicans of doing, and I totally agree, like what you said about Walmart. But when you have, at a time when everybody is suffering from working for less, just got through losing their homes, their jobs, and most, in many cases, their families, because the conflict that goes on inside a family when they're broke, people ending up in shelters, and that at that same time, Hillary Clinton and Bill have put together the biggest fortune of any ex-president, the $1 and $2 million that Reagan got or Nixon got from China. Yeah, right. That's big. The fact that George Bush probably gets $50,000 a speech.
Well, he got $100,000 from a wounded veterans group.
Yeah, but not $500,000.
Right.
I don't know anybody that's getting $500,000, and that's the from the 13 speeches he gave to people with issues before the State Department. You know, it doesn't mean yes.
Yeah.
Tom, you've been around. The fact that they didn't communicate that that I'm giving this speech and you've got to do this, there's no need for anybody who's smart.
The reality is, Bob, that there's no doubt in my mind that what they did, both Bill and Hillary, what they did was legal. The
legal
question,
but unethical.
The question is the optics of it.
Sure.
And the Republicans are going to assert that it's illegal. I don't buy that. I think they're smarter than that. And they're both lawyers. And but the optics of it, the Reagan era was a time when we celebrated great wealth. And when people made a lot of money, we said, oh, isn't that great for them? You know, Bill Clinton, hey, he became a millionaire. You know, they left the White House, what, $20 million in debt because they had paid for all the legal defense funds fees for Bill's defense on the impeachment and on the Paula Jones and all these other ones. They left the White House literally in debt. And now they've made it back. And if this was 20 or 30 years ago, you know, and we were still thinking in the Reagan era headset, we'd be going, wow, look at that. It's a rags to riches story. Good on them. But I think that we're in a populist era now. It's a different era. And I think that the Clinton family has misread that. I think they don't have a clear understanding of how populist the American electorate is right now. I don't disagree, Bob. This is going to be a problem for them.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That said, I really don't want this show to be the place where Republican talking points are recycled in advance. Welcome back. Jerry in Urbana, Missouri. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
I just got a question, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know Bernie, if he'd get elected, he'd have to contend with the military. I don't think people really realize just how large our military is. And would it be a wise choice for Bernie to tap General Wesley Clark and his administration if he should get elected? I'll take your response off the air, and whether or not they're friends or well acquainted. So
right.
I'll take my crest off the air, so I'll let you talk about it.
Okay, thank you, Jerry. Thanks a lot for calling, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. I don't know. First of all, I know that Bernie understands how big the military is, and Bernie was chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee and helped clean up the Veterans Administration, and a lot of vets are very, very grateful to Bernie for all of the stuff that he has done on their behalf, which has been substantial and consequential. Now, that said, Wesley Clark, I don't know. I remember when he ran for president, or was flirting with running for president, or was in the Democratic primaries back in the day. And he's been on this program probably 10 or 12 times. He used to come on when we lived in Portland, actually, was when he was on most frequently. And I think he lives in Oregon. I could be wrong, but I think he lives in the Pacific Northwest. But whether he's... I don't know that much about Wesley Clark to be able to answer the question intelligently. So, Robert in South Gray, South Carolina. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Well, there's some remarks about the Afghan war and the Middle East wars. I've come to the conclusion there's three things that wars generate besides profit, and that's widows and orphans and Gold Star mothers.
You're right. And enemies.
Yes, it generates lots of enemies.
Yeah.
All right, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Robert, for the call. Tom, watching Free Speech TV in Waterloo, Iowa. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. In response to your question about the sanctuary laws in San Francisco, I don't know if there is still an amnesty law on the book, but I know that they were trying to push through amnesty laws back when Bush was in the White House. And one of them was, okay, fine. I mean, if you find yourself in the country undocumented, no problem. I mean, turn yourself in. You go through a screening process, and they'll determine if you can stay or not. But it just comes down to, you know, getting a just simple criminal background check. And I don't know. Somebody just
to the best of my knowledge, Tom, there was never any legislation like you're describing proposed or put into place.
No, this was back in 2004. I think it was one of the things that Bush was trying to put into his campaign pledges. And actually, I wrote a paper on it. In a paper called 10 years of, or 4 years of insult. But yeah, it was one of the things that he was trying to push.
So do you think this was Bush looking at the 2004 elections and saying, let's suck up to the Hispanic vote?
Exactly. But I mean, in a way that did make sense. I mean, you know, I mean, at least, you know, make him go through a background check. I mean, this guy, I mean, he did some pretty horrendous things, and for him to just keep going back and forth like that.
Right.
Yeah, I think Obama was trying for it too, as you know, prior to the election. But I don't know exactly what happened to it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a sticky wicket, Tom, or a sticky thicket. We'll be right back. It's Anything Goes Summer, Anything Goes Friday. Your calls on whatever you'd like to talk about. Plus, I got a few more news stories, and I got to tell you how Andrew Jackson made his money after the break. Actually, after the top of the hour, Victoria Jones is up next. Stick around. Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, for all the news of the day, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Victoria Jones is on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Look forward to seeing you later.
How so?
I'm going to be on your show.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Oh, tonight on TV, you mean?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. I'm looking forward to that, too.
Yeah.
So what's up?
Well, a lot is up. FBI Director James Comey told reporters today that federal investigators made a fatal error when they were doing the background check on Dylan Roof, the man accused of shooting 9 people at a Charleston church last month. He said that the FBI began a background check, but a federal examiner did not obtain a report on a Columbia, South Carolina arrest record from March the 1st that showed that Roof had admitted to using drugs. Now, that should have disqualified him from buying a firearm. James Comey described the complicated city and county jurisdictional arrangement in the Columbia area that made it difficult for the FBI examiner to unearth the record. We are all sick that this happened, Comey said. We wish we could turn back time. Comey said that the FBI examiner ran numerous checks but didn't see that Roof had admitted to being an unlawful user of drugs. Now, his case was pending in South Carolina court, making it more difficult to find a concrete record, and they didn't find it.
Right.
They are meeting FBI officials with the families of the shooting victims to describe what has happened as an FBI mistake.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It also builds a good case for more rational gun control measures in this country.
Well, I think you're going to hear that next week, I'm quite sure, from Democratic lawmakers.
Yeah. Yeah.
In Congress.
Yeah.
I believe they're in session. Catherine Archuleta, the director of the Office of Personnel Management, has resigned from her post amid a massive and cascading scandal over her handling of an enormous breach of federal employee data. And this just one day, less than a day, actually half a day, after she said on a conference call with reporters yesterday, when asked if she would step down, she said no.
Hmm.
And this morning she's stepping down.
Yeah, yeah.
So she is gone. She will be gone as of the end of the day after she revealed yesterday that 21.5 million people's data had been stolen And Democrats are getting increasingly angry about this. Representative Adam Schiff, who's the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, says OPM officials gave misleading testimony during a classified briefing in June that he said sought to minimize the impact of the cyber attack. So,
is every executive branch, every cabinet group or whatever you want to call these, you know, the Office of Personnel Management, the FDA, the USDA, the Department of Defense, is each one of them responsible for their own cybersecurity? It seems like there should be a central, you know, command or authority or something that is responsible for cybersecurity for basically the entire federal government.
It does seem like that. No,
and why is she taking the hit for this when
she was responsible for the Office of Personnel Management?
Right.
She was responsible for her own records, and because there had been more than one auditor's government auditor's reports that had told her to take certain steps and had warned her about the insecurity of her own records, and she had ignored their warnings.
Ooh, not good.
No, really not good.
Yeah.
No, not really not good. No, each individual department seems to be separately responsible. And there was a fascinating New York Times piece about 3 weeks ago. I'll try and unearth it for you. But it went into great detail about the government auditor's reports on all the different government departments. And it was absolutely terrifying. The IRS has been using the word password for passwords.
Wow.
The Department of Education is very insecure, and that has all the information on student loans, so everybody's parents are at risk, or maybe they're already gone. Homeland Security is insecure. The Treasury is insecure.
Phew.
I mean, the number of departments that they talked about that were insecure was mind-boggling, and this has already happened. So even if they were racing to secure these, if you assume that the Chinese or whoever has been doing this were already working on getting in, you would have to reasonably assume that some of these departments have already been breached.
It seems that it's time to create a cabinet-level office just for cybersecurity for the rest of all government or something. I mean, you know, the idea that you've got, you know, 10, 20, 30 different departments, and each one has their own type of computer systems, their own software, their own programmers, and their own vulnerabilities, is crazy.
Yes. It seems like it's time to take it very seriously indeed.
Yeah. Okay. What else is up?
The Confederate flag was lowered from the grounds of the South Carolina State House this morning, ending its 54-year presence there and marking a stunning political reversal.
Meanwhile, in the House of Representatives.
Meanwhile, in the House of Representatives, mayhem yesterday afternoon. After Southern Republicans tried to get something introduced into a funding bill for the Interior Department that would have allowed the Confederate flag to fly at cemeteries, after earlier in the week they had passed an amendment saying that that would no longer be the case.
Hmm.
And there is a whodunit going on in Washington. This is sort of a minor aside, but it's kind of interesting because there's been a lot of reporting saying that the amendment that was filed yesterday that would allow the flag to fly was backed by Republican leaders, but nobody's named them.
Very interesting.
So they want to know who they are.
Yeah, Republican leadership, that would be what? Boehner, Kevin, what's his name?
Kevin McCarthy or Steve Scalise, probably, but nobody knows which.
Yeah, I would bet Scalise, but who knows? Victoria Jones, see you tonight, Victoria.
See you tonight.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of our program. It's Anything Goes Friday, summer, as it may, you know, as you prefer to call it. But I want to get this this thing of the $20 bill. There's this talk, there is actually serious talk in Washington, D.C. and in the Obama administration about taking Alexander Hamilton off the $10 bill and replacing him with a woman. And the question has been, who should the woman be? And I've, you know, my vote would go to Harriet Tubman. But that said, my vote would not go for the $10 bill. First of all, the $10 bill is one of the least used pieces of paper currency we have. The 10 and the 50 are the two least used. The most used is the 20. Second is the 5. Third is the 100. And so, and then you get to the 10 and the 50. So the thinking, I guess, is, well, if we're going to put a woman on a bill, let's you know, which is a disruptive thing, right? Because you're printing new bills. Let's do it with the bill that the fewest number of people use. I think that's lousy logic. You know, we changed the picture of Andrew Jackson on the 20 from one that used to look like Andrew Jackson to one that now looks like Henry Fonda. You know, we can change the picture again to Harriet Tubman, no problem. So why get rid of Andrew Jackson? Well, not only was Andrew Jackson, you know, I've talked about Andrew Jackson in the past in some of my rants about the Supreme Court in almost an heroic way, and it's really, I don't mean it that way, but to the best of my knowledge, the only two presidents who have openly defied the U.S. Supreme Court have been Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln did so when, in Dred Scott, the Supreme Court said people are property if their skin is of a certain level of darkness. And Abraham Lincoln said, no, we're going to ignore that, and we're going to issue the Emancipation Proclamation where, you know, Roger Taney can go to hell. Or Tawny, I guess is how it was pronounced back then. Andrew Jackson, now at that time, John Marshall was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who had been put on the court in 1800 by John Adams. And this was in the 1820s when Andrew Jackson was president. Andrew Jackson famously took the Cherokee, who, by the way, had achieved a very high level of sophistication as by Western standards. I would argue that all, and in fact, I wrote an entire chapter about this in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, that all of the Native American tribes across the United States were incredibly sophisticated in a sociological sense, in a cultural sense, and you know, in their understanding of governance and government and culture and society. But the Cherokees in particular, they had a written language. They published their own newspapers. They lived in houses. They had adapted, they had learned from the Europeans, and they were adapting many of these things that they had learned. And they lived in Georgia, among other places. And Andrew Jackson said, get them the hell out of the South and take them to Oklahoma and dump them there. Oklahoma is a word that in one of the Native American languages means place of refuge, or maybe dumping ground, I don't know. But so we had the Trail of Tears. And the Cherokee sued at the Supreme Court, and John Marshall, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, on behalf of the majority of the court, in the Trail of Tears case, said, no, you can't do that. You have treaties with these people. They have a right to stay here on this land in Georgia. And Andrew Jackson's famous response was, John Marshall has made his decision. Let him find an army to enforce it. And Andrew Jackson ordered the army to uproot the Cherokee from their homes in the southeast and move them to Oklahoma. And, you know, many of them, maybe most of them, died on the way. It was just a brutal march by soldiers on horseback, Indians on foot. But now I want to share with you, as Paul, the late, great Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. And I learned this from Steve Inskeep, the NPR writer or commentator, who wrote a piece for Politico magazine. And I'm pretty sure it's still up. This was published on the 4th of July. And I printed it out back then, and I've been waiting for a moment to share it with you. Steve Inskeep makes the note. He says, Jackson built the heart of the South, literally clearing the way for the settlement of part or all of seven southern states, Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, and Florida. He writes, it's also well known that Jackson was involved in expelling Native Americans from their homelands, which is how he made the room to create so much of the modern South. But it's not well understood why Jackson would make Indian removal a central theme of his career. And here's the story. Now, I'll just share with you Steve Inskeep's writing. I could summarize it, I suppose. But he writes, one titanic land grab shows how Jackson operated. Now, keep in mind, this guy was president of the United States at this time. It was the seizure of the Tennessee River Valley, where the Great River bends in what is present-day Alabama. While serving as a U.S. Army general, Jackson wrested control of the valley. Well, maybe this wasn't when he was president. While serving as a U.S. Army general, Jackson wrested control of the valley from Cherokees and turned it into an explosive real estate opportunity. Jackson and several friends made off with a breathtaking 45,000 acres, colonized the area, and even founded a new city. They then established multiple cotton plantations, what I refer to as concentration camps, run by enslaved laborers just as cotton prices were reaching record highs. All told, Jackson both created and scored in the greatest real estate bubble in the history of the United States up to that time. Pretty amazing, huh? And this is the guy on our $20 bill. Now, Alexander Hamilton, on the other hand, invented our modern banking system, invented our, the joke among historians is we all pay homage to Thomas Jefferson, but we actually live in Alexander Hamilton's America, which is true. Hamilton was a political enemy of Jefferson's and many other people. He was a great Revolutionary War hero. He's a general who fought alongside General George Washington. He was the first Secretary of the Treasury in the George Washington administration. And it was Alexander Hamilton, and I lay this out in the introduction in the first chapter of my book, Rebooting the American Dream, in excruciating detail, including some substantive quotes from Alexander Hamilton's proposal to Congress in 1791. It's called his Report on Manufactures, which you may be able to find online and read. The first two-thirds of it was his rebutting Thomas Jefferson's argument that America should be an agrarian and agricultural society. And he's like, no, we should be a great industrial society. And then he says, here's 11 points to do it. Put tariffs on imported goods so that there's an incentive for American manufacturers to manufacture to meet American demand. Subsidize American industries that are critical industries to the national health and the future of our nation. I mean, it's just a whole bunch of things like this. Alexander Hamilton built this country, or at least his policies built this country, right up until the Reagan administration. And we want to take his picture off the $10 bill? I say, you know, if you're going to take a dead white guy's picture off our money, I vote for Andrew Jackson. He's on the 20. And the guy was no hero. He murdered Indians in order to get rich. So my vote is that we put Harriet Tubman on the the woman of your choice on the $20 bill, not the $10 bill, or move Hamilton to the $20 bill and put her on the $10 bill. But if we're only going to have one woman on all of our various kinds of currency, why don't we put it on the currency that is the most used, the $20 bill? Maybe the most behind the $1 bill.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think any effort to get George Washington off the $1 bill, though, is going to encounter some serious resistance. We'll be back. Welcome back. Karen, watching Free Speech TV in Oxnard, California. Karen, are you on the air? Can you hear me?
Hi, yes. Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much.
Sure.
For letting me speak. I wanted to thank you very much for your bravery going on the air every day. I think you're every day. And talking about the things you talk about that nobody else is really willing to talk about or explore. I do personally believe from what I've seen and what I've read in the last several years doing extensive research that we seem to be morphing into a bona fide corporate fascist state, and you are uncovering this one story at a time, and I do very much appreciate that. But I do believe the underlying theory behind what we're seeing today is basically a corporate fascist takeover. For example, I believe in the TPP, if I'm correct, there is a law of sorts that gives corporations the right to sue individuals that interfere with them making a profit, for example. And that's just another, you know, little cog in the wheel that seems to be turning relentlessly. No matter what we do or say, many things have been pre-planned. For example, the secret energy meeting between Dick Cheney and the energy companies in 2001, I believe it has been exposed now, as most things that are done in the dark do come to the light eventually, that he had a secret meeting with many of the energy producers in the world and promised them U.S. tax dollars to drill, baby, drill everywhere and anywhere using advanced technology that has been developed and utilized, and we have patents just showing that they're in existence, technologies to find the oil deposits everywhere.
Technologies and, developed by Halliburton, a company that he owned stock in and was the former CEO of, yeah.
There you go. That's exactly what I'm talking about. It all seems to be interrelated, and you're acutely aware of this, and I just want to thank you so much for everything you do and everything you say, and your bravery is amazing. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you for your kind words. I appreciate it. I would say that it's not just like the Bush-Cheney administration were fascists of the first order, essentially. If you use the definition of fascism that Vice President Henry Wallace used back in 1945 when he wrote for the New York Times, that the American fascist is not like the German fascist. The American fascist is interested in acquiring political power so that using the combined power of the marketplace, which they already own, and the government, they can keep the common man in eternal subjection. And I would say it wasn't just the Bush-Cheney administration, although they were, you know, gung-ho for that kind of, if you want to call it fascism, feel free. I prefer to call it corporatism, because most Americans, you say fascist and they think Nazis. And we're not talking about Nazis here. We're talking about corporatists. But I would submit to you that every one of these trade agreements where we have surrendered our sovereignty and given our economy over to transnational corporations, going all the way back to permanent normal trade relations with China and NAFTA and CAFTA and now SHAFTA coming up, the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, also known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the TPP, that all of these are not just the fascist takeover or the corporate takeover of the United States, but of the entire world. And I would submit also that that's what you're seeing going on in Europe right now. That what Germany is trying to do is Germany has become more and more corporate friendly and less of a social welfare state over the last 20 years. They are trying to crush the left in Greece. This is their whole goal. Destroy. It's regime change. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. A couple other news stories here that I wanted to share with you today, and then we'll pick up your calls. Senator Bernie Sanders and three colleagues, Elizabeth Warren, Ed Markey, and Al Franken, senators from Massachusetts, and Minnesota, have asked the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, to investigate, quote, ridiculous prices, end quote, for cable and broadband services. A press release from Bernie's office that I am holding in my hands says, currently America ranks 25th worldwide for broadband speed, and we pay more for poorer quality broadband than customers in Slovakia, Estonia, South Korea, and the United Kingdom. Senator Sanders says, Americans deserve affordable access to the Internet, not hidden fees and rising prices. I hope Chairman Wheeler will take action and continue to defend American consumers. Good one. Meanwhile, you know, the founders had this idea that church and state should be separate. I laugh because the headline in the New York Times, this is back in March of this year, but it's ongoing right now. There's another one of these meetings happening as we speak or in this week, where this guy by the name of David Lane, who used to be a Bible salesman but has figured out that he can make a whole lot more money
bringing preachers together with politicians. This story by Jason Horowitz. One afternoon last week, David Lane watched on the sidelines as a room full of Iowa evangelical pastors applauded the defense of religious liberty by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. That night, he gazed out from the stage as the pastors surrounded Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana in a prayer circle. For Mr. Lane, a one-time Bible salesman and self-described former wild man, connecting the pastors with two likely presidential candidates was more than a good day's work. It was part of what he sees as his mission, which is to make evangelical Christians a decisive power in the Republican Party. An army, he said, that's the goal. Mr. Lane, 60, travels the country trying to persuade evangelical clergy members to become politically active. You know, in their correspondences before the Constitution was written, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison went back and forth on this. Jefferson used to call the clergy frauds. He was just right out in front about it. And he was very worried that a clergyman would ever become a member of the House, the Senate, or the President, God forbid. That if a religious leader became, you know, took that kind of power, that religion could corrupt the United States, that we were creating a secular republic, not a religious theocracy. And therefore, he worried about religious folks getting into politics. James Madison, on the other hand, his concern, he figured, you know, the people are not that stupid. They're not going to let that happen. But if the religious people start influencing politicians to give them money, if the federal government ever begins to subsidize religion, then the churches will become corrupted. Now, once again, Jefferson was a deist. He was not a Christian. And James Madison was a Christian, or at least professed Christianity. I believe he was Presbyterian. Might have been Congregationalist. And both of them thought that the fear of the other was silly. Madison thought, you know, there's no way Americans are ever going to elect a preacher president. And Jefferson thought, you know, there's no way that any sane American government is ever going to start passing out money to the churches. Well, they were both wrong and they were both right. The first veto of Madison's presidency, James Madison became president in 1809, and the first veto of, and served two terms, the first veto of his presidency was in 1809, and it was a piece of legislation that would have had the poorhouses here in Washington, D.C., which were run by the federal government since the first days of the George Washington administration. We, as a nation, using money that we got from tariffs, which were pretty much the major, they were pretty much the only thing that funded the federal government at that time. It's import tariffs. And in some cases, tariffs between the states, things like taxes on whiskey and whatnot, thus the Whiskey Rebellion. But in any case, the federal government used to fund the poorhouses here in Washington, D.C. The federal government paid for the housing, the clothing, the food, and the medical services for poor and indigent people in Washington, D.C., and disabled people. And in 1809, there was this religious wave that was sweeping the country. I mean, it was really quite intense. It was so intense that when Thomas Paine died, which I think was in 1807. I'd have to look it up. I don't have the exact year. But it was so intense that when Thomas Paine died, he had written this book called The Age of Reason, which basically was an ode to atheism. Thomas Paine was an atheist. And an attack on organized religion, that only seven people showed up at his funeral. I mean, he was considered such an outsider at that time. So anyhow, Congress passes a law that says, from now on, instead of Congress paying for the poorhouse, we're going to give the money to the churches and let the churches run the poorhouse. And James Madison vetoed that,
saying to do so would set a terrible precedent that our government should not be giving churches money. Well, when George Herbert walked, when actually when Ronald Reagan was president, and then this really went on steroids with George Herbert Walker Bush and his 1,000 points of light, Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush's emissary to the fundamentalist Christians in America was the son of George Herbert Walker Bush, George W. Bush. And, you know, and collectively they started this thing called the Faith-Based Initiatives, which Bill Clinton expanded and are still there. We are subsidizing religion with huge amounts of money all over the country. Religious schools, religious hospitals, all kinds of religious things. And now this guy wants to get the pastors more active.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
This is not only not the America that the founders and framers envisioned, this is dangerous stuff. We're talking about America becoming the Taliban. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the place where smart people get the news. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. An interesting piece over at Politico magazine. Donald Trump lied to us, too, by Antonio Torino. I'll just kind of refer you to that. I'm going to pick up your phone calls in just a second. I know there's a lot of people on hold, but there's just two things very quickly that I wanted to share with you. These both fall into the category of science, I guess. We could call this a geeky science alert. I'm a member of the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which publishes Science Magazine, which is arguably the best peer-reviewed science journal in the world, I think. And I just got my July 10th edition today. And there's this article. The headline is Targeting Copper to Treat Breast Cancer. But the headline doesn't tell the whole story. It's by Ken Garber, and I'll just share a little bit of it with you. Ken writes, in 2007, a woman facing an almost certain death sentence took a chance on a drug that needed a second chance itself. The woman had stage 4 breast cancer that had spread to her liver. She had what's called triple negative. This is a subclass of breast cancer that very often, well, I'll read you the article. This woman had the triple negative subclass of breast cancer, which is particularly aggressive and prone to bouncing back. Patients like hers usually relapse within a year, with death following swiftly. So as part of a 2-year clinical trial of advanced breast cancer patients, the woman began taking a drug that mops up copper. It's a copper chelator, thought to play a role in tumor growth. The drug, molybdate, it must have molybdenum in it, TM is what it, you know, it's how it's generally referred to, TM, had already failed a series of previous cancer clinical trials, but this new trial has since been extended several times, and there is still no sign of cancer in this woman after 8 years. The full trial results are equally striking, as Weill Cornell Medical College oncology fellow Eleni Nakos reported last month at the annual conference of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. At a median follow-up of nearly 5 years, 62 women in the 75-patient trial also had no detectable cancer. Keep in mind, all 75 of these women had stage 4 triple-negative breast cancer, which is highly, highly aggressive breast cancer. 5 years later, 62 out of 75, just taking this one drug. Among them were 12 of the 15 other women with stage 4 triple negative breast cancer, which means it's like metastasized to multiple organs, whose typical median survival is months. 5 years later, they're cancer free. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Yet the promise of copper depletion appears tarnished, not by clinical results, but by corporate strategy. WCMC oncologist Linda Vaidate, who led the trial, she's the one who, you know, now wants to proceed with a larger phase 3 trial of TM for triple negative breast cancer. In other words, she wants to, let's try this with a larger group of women who have this form of breast cancer that typically kills within months, who 62 out of 75 women 5 years later are still cancer-free. Let's try this drug in a larger trial. But The rights to treating cancer with TM are held by a Swedish biotech company that's developing the drug instead for Wilson's disease, a rare inherited disease of copper accumulation. The company, Wilson Therapeutics, has no immediate plans to test TM in cancer patients, its CEO acknowledges, and for now will not sublicense the drug. So in order for this corporate, and then they go into how they've tried this with mice, and Brewer with colleagues at UM gave TM to female mice, genetically engineered to develop breast tumors. None of the treated animals became cancerous, whereas more than half of the control mice did. Under a microscope, says Brewer, you could see dormant precancerous cells in the treated mice just sitting there, not growing, because they couldn't develop a blood supply. Copper apparently helps cancers develop their own little vascular system so they can steal energy from the rest of the body. So this treatment that is amazingly successful for triple-negative breast cancer is being withheld because the company that developed the drug will not license it, will not sublicense it for this use. It's amazing. And then one other, Damien Carrington in Paris writing for The Guardian. The headline, fossil fuel industry must implode to avoid climate disasters, says top scientist. Professor Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber, an advisor to the German government and an advisor to Pope Francis, said on Friday, in the end, it is a moral decision. Do you want to be part of the generation that screwed up the planet for the next 1,000 years? I don't think we should make that decision. He says an induced implosion of the fossil fuel industry must take place for there to be any chance, this is Damien Carrington's words, for there to be any chance of avoiding dangerous global warming. He said, do you want to be a part of an economy that is destroying the world or part of an economy that protects creation? Bingo. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Yes, I want to chime in on this notion of we being a Christian nation. I mean, one of the early drafts that Jefferson offered up to Franklin, keeping in mind that there was a committee that had been formed to write the Declaration of Independence, and they then decided to grant that task to Jefferson. Jefferson offered up an early draft to Franklin, and in that early draft, that the phrase that we hold these truths to be self-evident wasn't in there. Instead, Jefferson had written, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. And Franklin argued to him, no, we don't need to include the notion of some supernatural being or power. Instead, we need to rely upon what the Enlightenment has offered us, reason and rationality and logic. So we don't need to invoke a supernatural being. And people who want to talk about us as a Christian nation had this sort of amnesia or selectively, you know, picking and choosing out of historical quotations and pieces here and there in order to make their case.
Right. There's another one, Steve, I'll add to that. If you go through the various drafts, where Jefferson talks about nature's God in the Declaration of Independence, and I'm sorry, I can't quote that sentence from memory, but he put in nature's God. And John Adams scratched out nature's God and put the Christian God. And Thomas Jefferson then scratched out the Christian God and made it nature's God once again, because he was a deist. He saw God in all of creation, but not as an old man. Back to you, Steve.
Yeah, and I am still perplexed to this day in terms of the notion that somehow, because we do not have God in our governance and in our documentations, and we do not rely upon God or a supreme being in order to make law, that somehow that denies any individual, a group of individuals, the right to practice their faith. What you do in your own time is your own business, your own affair. If you want to, you know, invoke God, if you want to, you know, give him credit for all the good things that happen to you or the bad things, that's up to you. But the argument that those of us who are secularists make is that, well, that's fine for you, but as a country, we're not going to have that sort of structure because there's no reasonable way in which to govern given those facts, because everybody's got an interpretation as to what divine intervention or divine prodigy or anything that's supernatural, you know, how you define that, you know, from Baptists to Catholics to Methodists to Jews and all and so on. It would be absolutely impractical because you'd have a fight, you know, a theology on the floor of the Senate and the House of Representatives in terms of what God meant or what was his intent. I mean, so I to this day, it just perplexes me that people want that sort of government. At the same time, constantly denouncing those theocracies around the world that we are supposedly at war with because of their fundamentalist views in terms of Islam.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Steve. And Mikey Weinstein, you know, wrote a great book about this. He sued the U.S. Air Force Academy for evangelizing and proselytizing his son when his son was there, and wrote a book about it. He's been a guest on this program a number of times. The Family is another great book. I'm forgetting Jeff. His name sounds like Sharia. Jeff Charlotte, I think, maybe. But in any case. Wrote the book The Family, and it's about this fundamentalist Christian cult here in Washington, D.C., where they own a building and a bunch of members of the Senate and the House live there. And in fact, I think one of the cable TV shows is a takeoff on that. Jeff Charlotte, yeah, it's amazing. Steve, thank you for the call. It's a good point. Richard in Upper Tract, West Virginia. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I live here in the middle of Appalachia, and I've got a government job part-time where I interview people picked at random. And I talk to them about their work experience and their finance and so forth. And the thing that strikes me is because when I was much younger, I lived in Watts, okay? And the same social pathologies, the same lack of hope, the same assurances that the rich people control everything and nothing will ever be different, but yet the whites here, and it's 95% white, they run around with the rebel flag and they vote Republican probably 80-90%. But what they don't realize is they are basically the same as the poor blacks, and if they could only realize that, we could make so much progress with Bernie and so forth.
Well said. With or without Bernie, you're absolutely right. We need to wake people up to that, and that's one of the major jobs of Fox News, is keeping people in that trance. Fox so-called News, the official voice of the Confederate States of America. Richard, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday right after this. And welcome back. Brenda, watching Free Speech TV in Newport News, Virginia. Hey, Brenda, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I really want to thank you so much for your show. It makes me realize I'm not alone in the world.
Oh, thank you, Brenda.
You were talking earlier about a taxi ride that you took, and you saw an ad where Walmart was pledging to spend more on American products and goods, and you discovered that most of that would be in groceries.
Right.
And I would just like to point out that if they do, that's really just going to go back in their pocket, because they are one of the agribusinesses that receives 65% of the subsidies coming from the farm bill.
Really?
Yes. Remember a couple of years ago when they cut the food stamps, when that was the huge story about cutting the food stamps?
Right.
That was all part of the farm bill. Well, in that same measure, what they did was, remember, Boehner had proposed a $939 billion proposed expansion of agricultural subsidies, but it was reduced to a mere $195 billion expansion, and that was in July of 2013. But companies like Walmart, Monsanto, Kraft, and Tyson received 65% of that subsidy that's meant for farmers because they own so much of the agribusiness.
Wow. I'm not surprised. So, I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised by it.
Bottom line is, even if they only spend it on groceries, they're still not spending it because it's coming back into their pocket.
Right. It's called vertical integration. It's like the oil companies. They drill it, they refine it, they pump it. There you go. Brenda, thanks for that. Thanks for the tip. I appreciate the information. Donald in Lyon, New York, or Ilion, New York. Is that it, Donald? Am I saying that right?
Ilion, New York. You got it.
Great. You want to talk about the $10 bill? By the way, I stand corrected. The $1 bill is the most used, and the $2 bill is the least used. And I didn't mention either one of them when I was going through my list of bills. But back to you, Donald.
Yeah, I'm a first-time caller, and I love what you're doing.
Thank you.
And I wanted to tell you that Hamilton College, which is named for Alexander Hamilton, is against taking him off the $10 bill, too.
That makes sense.
So maybe you could partner with them and fight this.
Yeah.
Maybe you could even come up here and speak.
I think as the history of Andrew Jackson gets more widely known, and Politico, and Steve Inskeep did a great job with this article, we might get a little more momentum to say, you know, Andrew Jackson might have been a president, but he wasn't really that great. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, his...
So taking Alexander Hamilton off, like you say, makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, especially off our money, because Alexander Hamilton...
Our country.
Yeah, well, Alexander Hamilton invented our money. I mean, you know, he created the first bank of the United States.
Yeah.
That was very contentious, and presidents ran on the plane, including Andrew Jackson, as I recall. Maybe it was Zachary Taylor. I mix them up sometimes, but I think it was Jackson
I don't know if you've ever heard of Hamilton College. But...
No, I haven't. But it sounds good.
New York.
It's in New York.
Right here.
That's great. Donald, thanks for the call, and thanks for the heads up on that. I appreciate the information. We'll be right back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Nate Sweet and Troy Miller, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the companies that syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, SiriusXM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers that carry it, including Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, hey there, to Ellen Ratner, and I'm sorry I can't get into the chat room today, I don't know why, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Nay, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and most importantly, thank you to you for supporting our program. If you're listening on commercial radio, patronizing our advertisers, if you're listening on non-commercial radio or watching us on non-commercial television, for supporting those particular stations or networks, thank you so much. It's much appreciated. And thanks to Lori for filling in and answering the phones today, and to Troy for filling in for Shano, as Shane and Danielle are on vacation this week. Bourbon in Macon, Georgia, you are on the air. What's up?
Hey, yeah, I'd really wanted to, there's actually two things I want to talk about. Since you had mentioned Hamilton, and the $10 bill redesign, really what it's supposed to be is they're not going to get rid of Hamilton. They're just going to put a woman on there with him, which I'm pretty cool with. But speaking as a Native American, I would absolutely be fine if I never saw King Jackson again a day in my life. I would love to see him replaced by just any ethnic American from our history, like Dr. King, Harriet Tubman, anyone of that nature.
I'm with you, Bourbon.
But my second thing was that I wanted to talk about how Eisenhower, whenever he had left office in his farewell address, had warned us about the military industrial complex.
Right.
But I don't know if at the time it could have predicted the rise of what I like to call the corporate legislative complex, you know, the revolving door between all of our legislators and all of these various big industries. Because wasn't it at the time, like wasn't the trend even on Wall Street to work with the government to increase regulation?
Yeah, by and large, yeah.
And you know, the top tax rate was 91% throughout the Eisenhower administration, and he bragged about in his reelection of 56 about expanding Social Security, expanding unemployment benefits, expanding unionization. You know, I virtually, with the possible exception of Jimmy Carter, I'd say every president since, well, every Democratic president since 1980 has governed to the left of Dwight Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right. He warned us about the military-industrial complex, and I think he was very worried about it. He said, you know, this is going to have even a spiritual impact on the United States. And we're pretty much out of time here today, or I would play the clips for you, but maybe we can get to that next week. Bourbon, thanks for the call. Great point. Great point. Janine in Willis, Texas. Hey, Janine, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to comment about getting involved in politics and think you have to spend money to do it. I know you're supposed to, but I went when I was inspired by Obama, and I went and to the election center of the Democrats, and they were saying to buy the signs, and I said, oh, no, I want to go to all of my neighbors and ask them to put up a sign, and I want to give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, and I said, really, we're in Texas. You think that they're going to put a sign of a black man in their yard and pay for it? But anyhow, you have to keep pushing for your rights. I'm elderly, I'm 76, and if a person can get it for free, I do.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very good, Janine. And good on you for getting politically engaged. And thank you for the call.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Great to hear from you. Frank in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Frank, you wanted to talk about Ronald Reagan?
Yeah, Tom. I got one little piece of information that I picked up probably in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically about when Reagan's Alzheimer's was first diagnosed. I was reading online that a lot of people, he announced it in 93, but he was diagnosed in 1981.
91?
Not
81, I mean?
No, 81.
The year that he was sworn into office?
Well, no, it was the year he was, they had the assassination attempt. What happened was he was tested at GW Hospital for residual effects of the anesthesia.
Right.
And boom, they found it. And the way I heard that was that I knew a medical student in the early 90s at GW, and she had been at a party with the head of psychiatry who happened to be on watch when Reagan was rolled in. He told her that was when it happened.
Wow. Now, early Alzheimer's is a whole different thing from late-stage Alzheimer's.
Exactly, but again, that was when it popped up.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense. I mean, typically it's detectable in a fairly faint way for about a decade before it just blows up in your face.
Right, but I mean, to me, it answered a lot of questions about why he was so clueless a lot of times. But that's just me.
Right, and why he took a nap every afternoon, and why he was.
Well, that's okay. You know, George W. Bush did like to do that. When he didn't get his nap, he was cranky.
Yeah, yeah.
And did things like lies and the wars. Anyway, thank you for all your good work.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. I appreciate the call. And, we have 5 seconds, literally? Okay, I'm not going to put another call on. It wouldn't be fair. I'm sorry. But that's it for the show, and that's it for the week. Thanks so much for being with us this week. Thank you to Troy and Laurie and Jim for the great job that you all have done in the absence of Shane and Danielle. And Louise and Sean and Sue and everybody else who helps put this show together. Thank you for you. And please remember that democracy is not a spectator sport. It really and genuinely does require all of us to participate. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. I'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.